And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of February 18th, 2019. Today I'm joined by my co-host, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
I'm well. How are you?
Very well, very well. So, what's cooking?
So today I thought we could talk about the science on climate change. There was a big report released by NASA about 2018 being the fourth warmest year on record, and also talk about some of the other interesting science, like polar bears that are invading towns in Russia.
Oh, really? Okay.
And then also maybe talk about what does that mean for the fossil fuel industry and its sort of future prospects,
uh-huh.
No pun intended there. Does that sound good?
Sounds good to me. Let's go.
So NASA scientists announced on February 6th that the Earth's average surface temperatures in 2018 was the fourth highest in nearly 140 years of record keeping, right? So we are definitely in a warming trend, unmistakable warming trend here. This is from the New York Times. And 18 of the 19 warmest years have occurred since 2001. So,
wait. 18 of the last, in the last 19 years, we've had 18 of the warmest years on record.
Yeah.
Just to say that a different way.
Right? Yep,
okay.
Yep.
Okay.
And there's a quote from Gavin Schmidt, who's the director of the Goddard Institute for Space Studies, who said that we're no longer talking about a situation where global warming is something in the future. It's here, it's now. So we're definitely, and it's one of those things where if you are seeing the effects of climate change, it means that it's really quite far along, right? Because for a long time, it was just what you could see in the models. And so now we're really moving forward here. The other thing that they talked about in this article, sometimes, I don't know if this happens to you, Ted, but sometimes people will say to me, The climate's always changing, right? It's always changed. You know, that's always what's happening. And I know that that's not the case, but it can often be sort of like, well, how do you even begin to answer that? Because certainly, you know, and this New York Times article addresses it. It's, we have seen hotter days in the prehistoric times and colder ones in the modern era. But this, what's really different about this is that it's been a sudden rise in temperatures, and there's a clear correlation with increasing levels of greenhouse gases.
Mm-hmm.
And that's different. That's different than anything. Greenhouse gas is produced by humans. So it's definitely something that we know is anthropogenic, and that it's correlated with these anthropogenic, meaning caused by humans, and it's correlated with carbon dioxide and methane that we're producing through a variety of ways. Mm-hmm. And so there's no question that we are changing the climate. And you know, there's also no question that I would want to live in the hotter days from prehistoric times or the colder ones from the modern era. So, yeah. You know.
Yeah. I think when you think of a climate in stasis, right, an equilibrium situation from year to year. So if the last 20 years were truly no change in global warming, then on average, half the years would have been above average temperature and half the years would have been below average temperature, right? I mean, that's
right.
Over. And the fact that you have 18 out of the last 19 years being on one side of the ledger means it's clearly not statistical anymore. There's something driving it. It's like if there's a book called The Black Swan about probabilities, and the guy posits an engineer who firmly believes every time you flip a penny, it's either 50%, you know, tails, 50% heads. And you flip the coin 100 times, you get 99 tails every time you flip it. And you ask the engineer, say, well, what's the next? Is the next one going to be 50-50? And he says, yeah, I believe the next flip of the coin is 50-50. But you ask the streetwise person, and they say, there's something wrong with that penny, right? There's
no penny that's
going to flip 99 times the same way. You look, 18 out of the last 19 years being hotter than normal means something's going on.
Yeah. Yeah, and I read up on this a little while ago, so of course the changes in the climate are all based on changes in the energy balance of the Earth, which requires some sort of an external forcing, like changes in the solar output or the albedo effect, and they're cyclical, right? So these forcings were cyclical in the ice ages. So yes, there have been these sort of swings, but scientists track these cyclical forces. So they know when to expect them and when they're going to happen. And they have some idea that this is the pattern of these things. And the current, this, you know, 18 out of the last 19 years is no longer part of this pattern. Mm-hmm. We are well beyond the pattern. So even though there have been some of these swings, this is very, very different. Right. And the only way to explain, the only forcing that could be having right now is from anthropogenic impact. So that's...
You say forcing, what do you mean by a forcing? Just briefly, so if people aren't familiar with that language. A forcing is, I think, a description. It's a word that climate scientists use to talk about what influences the weather, either it influences the energy balance. So a positive forcing is the amount of sunlight that is coming into the atmosphere, right? That's pretty much constant with small variations as the sun gets a little bit hotter, a little bit colder, but there's a positive forcing. Then there's a negative forcing, which is the reflection of that sunlight from all the little dust particles in the air. Right, so there's positive forcings, negative forcings. They're basically contributions to the amount of energy that's coming into the system. And that's what all these models do, is they compare all kinds of different forcing mechanisms, different ideas, right? Is there too much carbon black on the snowpack? Is there, there's a whole bunch of them. But that's the forcing idea, so...
Right. So the next time someone says to you, you know, well, the earth has always changed. Now you know what to say. It has not ever changed quite like this.
That's right.
And it has not been due to it. It's been the balance and the physics, which we are definitely knocking out of balance.
That's right.
So, some of the influences of knocking the physics out of balance is this story I did a little teaser about, the polar bears that are terrorizing an island town in Russia, and they say climate change is to blame. And I mean, this is like, it's not humorous, but at the same time, you're thinking like, really, is this truly happening, that polar bears are terrorizing a small town? And they are. I mean, this is, I guess there was maybe 52 bears that have been they've been dealing with in this town.
Pronounce it in Russian. Yeah, I want to hear you pronounce it in Russian.
Belushia guba. And it's part of the Novaya Zemlya Russian archipelago. Uh-huh. But at any rate, there's a town there, and it's been the polar bears are typically, are born on land, but they live mostly on sea ice, where they hunt and feed on seals. And we've all seen the pictures of the polar bears losing their sea ice, right? And that's, for a while, was sort of the poster for climate change and why we should be concerned about it. But it has sort of, people have said that should be replaced really with, you know, posters of children who are having trouble breathing and different things like that, right? Mm-hmm. But at any rate, we know that the polar bears are having issues. And so what that has turned into is the polar bears are moving back onto the land, and they're starving, they're ravenous, which leads them into contact with human populations. And of course, you can imagine, if you know, you go out to your garage and there's a polar bear
rummaging through the garbage
and it's big and it's scary, that's a little bit unnerving. And they've been, I guess they've had to put fences up around schools to keep them out, around kindergartens. And
I mean, I've heard tell that polar bears are pretty mean animals. I imagine a hungry polar bear could be a particularly ferocious thing to bump into in your garage.
Took away my ice. I'm coming for you. And you know, the other thing that I heard when I was up in Alaska this past summer on a cruise, and one of the things they've been talking about is how polar bears and I don't think it's all of the grizzly bears. It's just there's like, actually, I think maybe just three grizzly bears that are doing this, but they've started mating and they're producing what are called growler bears. Wow. So they're sort of like a polar bear, but maybe with a brown nose and brown, you know, sort of brown feet.
Really?
And it's sad, of course, because they're actually not, they're not good on the ice and they're not good on land, right? Because they're not made for either. But it's just the result of, you know, the polar bears don't have anywhere to go, and so they're kind of coming back on land and causing a lot of different challenges.
And pressures, and I mean these weird manifestations of climate change, right?
Right. Exactly. Wow. Exactly. Yep. So, crazy stuff. So yeah, and then I think we're going to talk a little bit about what that means for, you know, we talked some about the manifestations for wildlife, but what is this, the manifestations of this, you know, it's official 2018 is the fourth warmest year on record. What does that mean for the fossil fuel industry and its viability?
Okay.
And I think you had read something about Los Angeles.
There's something, so in Los Angeles, so the great city of Los Angeles has a mayor, I think his name is Garcetti. I'm not that familiar with the politics in LA, but it turns out that given the fact that the state of California over the last couple of years has committed to being carbon neutral by 2050 or something, there's a state mandate to reduce carbon emissions. And the mayor of Los Angeles recently made a decision to reverse course, actually, and essentially block the construction of new gas-fired peaker plants in the Los Angeles area. So I think the way the story goes is that there's something like 9 or 10 gas-powered plants along the Pacific coast that provide electricity for Los Angeles, and they were looking to build 2 or 3 more. And the problem with the gas-powered plants on the Pacific Ocean is they were taking in seawater, warming it up, and then putting the warmer seawater back out, which was detrimental to the local aquatic life, right? And so there was environmental challenges to the peaker plants, but with the advent of better battery storage and wind and solar, I guess the mayor decided to make the commitment to go to not build a new gas-powered plants and go with wind and solar. And so that's a fairly clear statement. And I think this Mayor Garcetti talked about how it was a manifestation, that's my word for the night, of the Green New Deal, right? Here's an opportunity, here's where the kind of place where the Green New Deal hits the ground, because they're talking about a 10-year plan, which at this point has to be kind of aspirational, because who knows, you know, they're going to phase out these power plants over the next 10 years. So there's going to be a lot of heavy lifting between now and then, but you got to start somewhere. And it's a good on Los Angeles for making that commitment. It's the biggest city. I don't know if it's the biggest city in the world, but it's a big, big geographic city and it needs the power. And the mayor of Los Angeles has done the right thing. So kudos on him.
Yeah, that's great. And then we have some stuff going on in Massachusetts, right? With not quite the same, right? But we've got Eversource, which is really starting to switch over to maybe even, you know, could it be switching over to wind power, right?
Well, I think this is a real, real pronounced or kind of a watershed moment. So what's the background? Eversource is supposed to provide power to the region, right? The New England region. Massachusetts is the biggest component of that. And if you've listened to this podcast, we can go back and dig up the shows. But both the Northern Pass, which was to bring hydropower down through New Hampshire, and a separate one, even though I forget the name, that was coming down through Maine, both of those big power lines went kaput, right? Can't be gotten. So now Eversource needs to produce electricity over the next few decades, clean electricity, and their options are being limited. And I saw an article in the Globe basically saying that Eversource has, because they can't get the power from Hydro-Quebec in time, they're committing to the wind and solar, in particular the wind solutions. A few weeks ago, we talked about how there was an auction, right? So the government, I think the federal government, auctioned tracts of open ocean off the coast of Massachusetts and for the development of wind turbines, and those went for an incredibly large amount of money. And it turns out that Eversource has now bought 50% ownership of the companies that are planning to develop those offshore tracts of ocean with wind turbines. So that's a really interesting development, because I've argued that these companies like ExxonMobil should be considering themselves an energy company and not necessarily just an oil company. I think the same thing is true here of Eversource. They're going to try and brand themselves, I think, as being a leader in greenness. And if it's true, great. I think the when I first saw the headline, I was like, oh my God, Eversource is going to buy the wind turbines and bury the whole thing, just like GM killed the electric car in 1999, right? That you buy half and say, oh no, we're going to slow walk the whole thing. But what I've seen says that they really are truly committed. And one of the reasons I think they're truly committed is because Massachusetts, at the behest of climate activists like you all, has passed an aggressive requirement to have offshore wind development. So the state of Massachusetts is behind it, and that means Eversource can line up with this with some confidence. So basically, it's a policy success. It's a green energy policy set by the state of Massachusetts has encouraged Eversource to buy into the idea of generating power offshore. I mean, it has the potential to be great, and I think it has a potential to be an example, as I say, a watershed as to which way other big electric generation utilities or providers of electricity, which way they're going to go. And if they buy into the idea of green power, that's a good thing.
Yeah. So there's a company called Statoil. I want to say I can't remember exactly where it's from, maybe Denmark, but I don't think that's correct. But anyways, there's a company that was sort of a fossil fuel company, and they made the big switch and changed their name to Equinor. Now, we talked about them a couple podcasts ago, and have really been pushed. They have rebranded themselves as an energy company, as you mentioned, as like, we're not just here to give you fossil fuel energy. We understand that if we want to exist into the future, if we want our business to still be around, we have to start changing our business model and become
right.
supporting and all of these new types of energy. This is the future. This is innovation. This is technology. You can't, be a technophobe, because even though solar energy has been around forever, right? But
No, I completely agree. I mean, if we see these different companies moving this way, it's a good sign. It's a good sign for all of us.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and just a couple to follow on to that, another big report that came out was the National Intelligence Community. Mm-hmm. The Worldwide Threat Assessment was released by the Director of National Intelligence. And it talked about the worldwide threats from climate change, that they pose, risks to global stability because they fuel competition for resources and economic distress and social discontent. And so there's so many pushes from so many different directions, the animals, the invading humans, human, locations, and the problems that we're having with sort of, well, not problems, but the transitions that people are making toward renewable energies and being successful, and the environmental justice problems that come if we don't transition this way. And then, we hear these things about the threat to our safety and security, and it's definitely time for these fossil fuel companies to make these kinds of changes, for sure.
I'm with you on that. And you know what else is time for? I think it's time we gotta put the show down. What we'll do is we'll put links up on the podcast at massclimateaction.org/blog and on the Facebook page at /massclimateaction. You can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher or TuneIn Radio or Podbean or particularly Apple Podcast, where you can rate us, which is good for the show. And if you want, and I encourage you to, please send an email to podcast@massclimateaction.org. You can tell us about the weather in your town, how many polar bears you've seen today, new ideas for shows that you'd like us to talk about, or complaints about things we haven't touched on. We're open to suggestion. So we're going to close where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability, because we accept responsibility for a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan. where that plan uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our future. So, Mariah, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.